So in the last 2 years, you've managed to hire about 200 people, have 6 products with over 30 cloud connectors, which is kind of mind-boggling under the circumstances, under any circumstances, especially given what we have seen in the last year. How the hell did you hire so many people so fast in the middle of a pandemic?
A little update on that. We had 10 products and over 100 connectors.
Oh, holy cow. I may have written this question 2 weeks ago, Rehan.
I think it was probably part of a blog which was when we launched an RSA VM6 product.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Zero to Exit. This is Ankur. In today's show, we are excited to have with us Rehan Jalil, CEO of Security.ai. Rehan is a serial entrepreneur who has had 2 very successful exits with Vicarious and Elastica. On his third sojourn at Security.ai, Rehan wants to solve the data privacy and security challenges in the cloud and AI era. In today's show, we want to ask Rehan about his product and company building philosophies, talk about the state of data privacy and security, and get into the psyche of a serial entrepreneur. Hi, Rehan. Welcome to the show.
Ankur, thank you so much for hosting. Excited to be here.
Yeah. Thanks for taking the time. I know the life of a CEO in a young company is always busy, but certainly appreciate that. To kick things off, I was really curious about, you've been in sort of the people and product building mode, right? Like you're still in the relatively early stages of a startup journey in the midst of a pandemic. What's been the biggest surprise for you in the last 1 year?
Ankur, actually, more than the surprise is a bit of an internalization that if you did not have these high-speed global networks, and if you did not have these rich set of apps and services that sit on top of it, like collaboration, e-commerce, and healthcare, and the cybersecurity that protects all of these things, the suffering would have been a lot more. The key thing is it enabled collaboration that you have the most advanced mRNA-based vaccines. They came in under record times. And frankly, thanks to all the technologies that are working hard out there to have enabled this infrastructure that we're able to pass through it. Now, in terms of surprise, I would think that the sentiment swing that happened from almost like a nuclear winter almost being declared in the early days to almost like running for Dogecoin, in a matter of a few quarters.
So many exciting, surprising things. Obviously, vaccine in record time. Nobody had predicted Dogecoin and AMC and GameStop stock to go so high. And the state of SaaS and security, right? Like all the trends that I think people who are in technology and take for granted, like they all got accelerated, right? Like everything happened sort of basically a decade happened in 2 years. But yeah, I couldn't agree more about the infrastructure that was able to support this. Going right into the sort of your company journey, right? Like, so before you started Elastica, you were in the cellular and networking business, especially with Vicarious and Tel Labs, which Vicarious got acquired by Tel Labs. But then you made a switch at some point to cybersecurity. Why did you get into cybersecurity?
Actually, it's quite an interesting story. I probably would take you all the way back when I was a young teenager. Cybersecurity probably wasn't called cybersecurity. We just joined engineering school, the first year of engineering. My dad got me, IBM compatible PCs that they used to be calling at that time. It was a novelty for a teenager to have. First year of engineering, we noticed a weird thing. It used to have floppy disks. Then in the boot sector of the floppy disk, there were the weird text and characters. And if some machines, you would put that floppy disk, and any machine after that, if you put the floppy disk, you would have the same characters. What we really learned is we were dealing with one of the very first virus ever for DOS machines. It was called C-Brain. So my friend TZ and myself, and of course led by him, we built the very first antivirus. McAfee didn't exist at that time. And based on our marketing brilliance, we called it Anti-Brain. And we literally tried to sell that software. If you remember in those days, at least in that part of the world where I come from, there was no honor code on software licensing. So it was stolen pretty quickly. So that was really the first thing, but I could have never imagined that it would become the profession over time. And similarly, I think it's part of a bit of a need driven at that time. If you remember, the environment, at least where I come from, was, there used to be a lot of theft. My dad had gotten me a motorbike, and with my mom's prayers, it got stolen. And we ended up building some security systems. So the next thing that you have a car or something, you know, the gadget would be put in, and if something was stolen, it would kind of shut things down and lock things up, right? We couldn't really productize it. It was second year of engineering because the COGS was too high. And same goes for in home intruder detection systems. So I think the journey kind of perhaps, I can now connect the dots looking back that perhaps there was always an inclination, but I could have never imagined this would be the profession. This is where the life goes, because I was really passionate about building processors and chips, and these things look very easy, and the processors and silicon, and they look like rocket science. I'm really passionate about doing that. And that I ended with my first job, but I didn't know I'll eventually end up in cybersecurity.
Yeah, love that part of the story. Were you always, as a kid and even growing up, like a hacker, programmer type of guy, or more like asking people to build the stuff that you like, a la Steve Jobs? What was your brand back in the days?
I think it was kind of a mix. It was concepts as well as loved coding. But at that time, software coding didn't seem to me as rocket science. Frankly, it is. It was perhaps a wrong interpretation. I was much more into electronics and building gadgets and understanding how the magic of silicon works. And that looked like rocket science to me, and how to crack that code. And frankly, initially went on that path, working with Sun Microsystems on building very early multi-core processors, being part of as an engineer in that. But I think it's a mix of a journey. I mean, very hands-on in the early days. And then, of course, subsequently, you really have to count on your amazing team members to pick that responsibility.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So going from the college to, you know, your first job, fast forwarding all the way, time scale, getting back to Elastica. And obviously, you know, I've been fortunate to obviously see your and Elastica's trajectory. One of the things that kind of stood out for me and a lot of the people who were sort of looking at the company and the product was that you've always been sort of a very product-focused CEO, more specifically somebody who had an eye for design. So, you know, just the user interfaces, even with your current product and back in the days, were just really beautiful products. Now, the reality is that obviously with Apple devices, like everybody wants to talk about the design first principles, but like, you know, the reality is that, and I won't name names, there are tens of hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap company who actually have a really crappy design. But design was a thing that you always sort of, your product stood out. So tell us a little bit about like, why is that such an important part of B2B and security professionals? And why is that such a thing that you made sort of your own in your journey?
Yeah, I think in my own thought process, and perhaps it's just inclination, but more importantly, I think design and user experience is not about prettification, but it's about empathy with the user of the product. It's the relationship between the human user and the product running on a machine, right? So what does it really mean? What it means is that certain products, not all, certain products, they need to have a very complex information exchange that has to happen between the product and the human. And that information exchange has to be fluid, it has to be frictionless, it has to be very high bandwidth between these two people things that are trying to, you know, make sense of each other. And if you, facts to keep in mind, 50% of the brain cortex is dedicated to processing visual information. So if you actually have something visual, you're probably going to do the information exchange much faster. And the brain can actually process images tens of thousands of times faster than text. And some people say about 60,000 times, and I don't know, who knows, but it's tens of thousands of times faster. So if you can actually take, cybersecurity is complex. So if you can take all the goodness of the product and establish that relationship and information exchange that is happening between the human and the machine, using the design and the user experience, at least we believe that you add value to what you're trying to give to the customer. Now, it's not true for all products, but at least the products that we picked upon, we thought it makes a difference, and we invest a lot of time on it.
Yeah, well said. I think it was a tweet or something one of these days. It said, Apple is an example of why design matters, and Amazon is an example of why design does not matter. So you've got sort of these two opposite at the end of the spectrum where two companies, and this is not to say Amazon doesn't design good product interfaces, but like just very different philosophies in terms of running the product.
What I want to say, maybe I disagree with whoever said that. Like, think of this way. Whoever came up with Alexa, they really thought through what relationship the machine should have with the human. And they took out every friction possible that you do not have to look at it. You do not have to point your fingers at something. You're going to communicate the way you're going to communicate you do with any other human. That's user interface design, right? It doesn't have to be visual. So I think it's kind of a not giving, frankly, them the credit that they enabled. And they actually opened the minds of hundreds of millions of billions of people, perhaps. And then a lot of people followed what Alexa was able to do. Frankly, which other was not able to open the mind. So I think they did a brilliant job in creating that user interface, which doesn't have to be just visual.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that is true. It's not just a visual design, but it just interact. And like you said, how humans interact with the machines, and it has a lot of importance. How have you been able to attract like some of the top designers in the industry? Like, is there a trick to it? Or is it just like sort of having found the right people, they've kind of stuck with you over the course of your company building and product building journey? Mm-hmm. I asked this question, sorry, Rehan, because like finding amazing designers, especially in Silicon Valley and just generally, it's just a tough, tough things. But you've managed to sort of always crack the code on that. So I wanted to get a little bit insight into that.
Yeah, first of all, certainly the credit goes to the security team, Elastica teams. I think a bit of that is the birds of a feather go together in some ways. So if you have one initial few team members who actually value design, and then other team members who also not in your team, but they value design, they're probably going to try to join the mission along with you. And there again, is important that it is not just prettification. It is going to the essence of trying to establish a relationship with the user. And I think you really, when you're building the team, you really want to assess that. That they actually stand for just the colors, or they stand for actually, you know, that information exchange that has to happen both sides and making it easy. And that's really the trick.
No doubt about it. I think finding people with an eye for design and then sort of, like you said, birds of a feather, I think they'll go and get attracted to companies who actually value the importance of design. Kind of switching the gear a little bit from sort of design to sort of your own kind of company building and category building journey. If you look at sort of your career in the last decade, you've helped define several categories, right? So at Elastica, you were sort of the pioneer in the what's called CASB, a cloud access security broker category. Now you're on the path to creating a new category in data. And one of the things, oldest playbook in startup building is like, well, tread the red ocean, not the blue ocean, because red ocean, existing markets, existing category, you can just have a little bit of a better mousetrap and people will buy. Treading the blue ocean is hard because it requires a lot of investments and marketing and getting your word out there. But you've not been afraid to tread those blue oceans and create new categories. So two-part question. One is obviously like why this fascination of category creating products? And two, why do you think sort of a category needs to exist, a completely new class of products need to exist in the data space, which is what you're passionate about?
Mm-hmm. Ankur, this is really the core question when you about to start your journey on do something new. And I think it's more about, it's a function of what you really get inspired about. Whether are you trying to solve something that has either not been solved because the problem is going to be new or not been realized as yet, or you're trying to find a brand new way of trying to solve an existing problem, either actually gives you opportunity to define and build a category, right? Now, if the market is big and then you have a shot at it, that it is going to become important enough, worthwhile enough to get people's attention to actually, first of all, define a category, that's not sufficient. You really want to be the category leader, but you can define a category and, you know, go sideways. You actually have to do both. But these things have to be lining up. Now, in the case of Elastica, when we started back in 2012, we did some initial quick prototyping. We took it to customers. I can tell you, almost all meetings, we got smirked at by some of the big time CISOs. Because why? Because it was not common sense. SaaS wasn't there. Yeah. And we were kind of preaching that you need a security for SaaS. And they were telling us like, hey guys, we don't have SaaS. We probably have one or two apps and we're probably never going to go SaaS. And even if we do go SaaS, why would we actually have a third party connect to our SaaS apps and start controlling and monitoring it? Like, it's not going to happen. The level of doubt I can tell you early days of last year in 2012 was so high in everyone's mind, including mine. But you actually had to have some level of conviction that, you know, puck is going to go there. And that's your North Star. And I think, again, luck has to line up. You could have been too early. The luck lined up that in the next 18 to 24 months, the SaaS adoption kind of took off. Office 365 came. And that wasn't sufficient. We had to perform. And perform really means that you basically have to have category-defining products where Forrester put us as number one leader, Magic Quadrant put us as MQ leader, and so the story kind of goes along the line. But I think that really is needed, and that's something what you aspire to do. Second example would be Symantec. I mean, Symantec, when even after acquisition, the clear thought and the thesis of acquisition, Symantec was that we can define something as an edge security. SASE name didn't exist. And we had the SWG, we had the CASB, we had the Fire, you know, we had the reverse proxy. And we essentially then did acquisitions like Fireglass and Luminate to define something on the edge. And of course, later it became SASE. That was an attempt towards, of course, again, a category definition. And security is I think we frankly here aspire to define multiple categories. One on the privacy side, privacy ops already, if you Google it, you'll see it. People actually have titles of privacy ops in their names now. And I think we're helping to define it. And Forrester's putting us as a leader and IDC is. But I think the story is going to continue because data, and we'll talk more about data, is the center of innovation and the center of obligations. And I think there's more opportunities, which I'm happy to share on you that also.
Yeah. No, we want to talk about data. Obviously, that's a big part of the conversation today. But before we get there, one of the things that you mentioned, I wanted to double click on that, which is that 2012, you start Elastica, you're starting to see that need for SaaS security before even CISOs, your customers, could realize that. A lot of product and company building and entrepreneurship, quite frankly, is looking around the corners for the next big wave. And what over the course of your experience, have you learned? Like, what are the skills you need to always look for where the puck is going to be? What skills are required? Is it a deliberate practice? Is it talking to like-minded people? How do you get there in terms of making a bet on what's going to be the next big thing?
That's really the hard part. First of all, you have to be very honest and clear-minded in yourself. I mean, in the sense that you can be... can just have some emotional attachment to certain concepts that you kind of, it shouldn't be some technology looking for a problem. Where you're literally trying to see the trend lines and where this thing is going to go and whether those trends actually have underlying a big tectonic shift that it can create. And of course, you have to take a bet on it because you could be very early you may run out of cash by the time that shift actually happens. Or frankly, you could completely be wrong, completely off base, right? And I do have to say that's the hardest part of actually company building or category building kind of a process itself. And there's no easy answers to it. Only easy answer is that your customers, I would say, is almost never going to be able to tell you. They're not going to tell you they exactly need that because they have burning fires for that quarter or next couple of quarters. They're not thinking through that. Whereas you actually have to pick all the signals and form a picture in your mind that, yes, this is the tectonic shift happening potentially. Just like we did in VicoVerse when we were doing 4G and application controls on packet core networks, and then Elastica, and then now with privacy ops and other things. But you're taking a bet because you could completely be wrong, and luck has to be on your side. There's no right answer to it.
Yeah, there is none. One of my startup CEO used to say, "You in startup journey, you're either too early or too late." and timing it is like fool's errand. Like Apple was not the first touch device, right? Like there were a lot of experiments made. Same thing with iPad, but it sometimes you got to experiment. Some of them will stick and some of them won't. And that's hard part of the journey. So switching gear to obviously data as being the big next big challenge. So let's talk about kind of the state of the union of data and why you see that as a big opportunity. Now, you obviously have an explosion of unstructured data set, more and more SaaS application, AWS S3, all kinds of applications. But also you've got a lot of structured data, the Snowflake, the BigQuery, Databricks. I mean, it's just every other day there's like a new data store out there. And AI and ML is just making the need for data and analysis of the data even more and more important. So I think data is a big thing, huge, you know, market opportunity. What do you see specifically in the security space that hasn't been solved yet and people are not thinking about it that gets you super excited to obviously, you know, build security.ai and has you a passion about?
Yeah, just like you mentioned, data brings two big O's. One is the big opportunities that is there. The other is a big obligation. And those obligations are in broad buckets of keeping it secure, have responsible use with respect to privacy, because individuals have rights on their data. And of course, various different kinds of compliances that you have to make sure that you're meeting those, right? As you rightly pointed, there's an explosion of data and it is getting even more distributed. And because there's an inflection point here going to multi-cloud and systems that are inherently multi-cloud, which means people are going to already looking at how the controls that existed in the on-premise world, are they portable? Or this is the right disruption point to rethink through and have these all three big O's be solved in a more holistic way rather than looking at it in silos. And scale is very different because, you know, now you're talking about hundreds of terabytes of data coming every day, perhaps even more for many companies. And the downside is actually very, very, very significant because of new privacy laws and other things that are coming along. So that I would call it as the, again, it's a point in time opportunity for a certain number of years that in transition when it's going on, you can redefine the architecture, how you can do it holistically, not look through the lens of traditional DLP only, not look through the lens of traditional on-premise appliances only, but look through the lens of what we call sensitive data intelligence. Establish the intelligence across all these touch points. Establish an architecture where you can actually handle these volumes of data at scale. Establish a common grammar across all these different disparate systems and give something to the world where they can handle all these three big O's of securing it, keeping it private, and being compliant. And we clearly can see in the landscape right now, it has not been done. Either people are taking the old approaches of whatever DLP systems existed, you know, taking them porting as appliance on the multi-cloud side of things, or frankly, doing it in silos. Even the cloud native systems, they have their own things. Everyone has their own thing. So I think we clearly see that there is actually going to be a need of unifying it all together over time. And I think if somebody does it right, there's an opportunity to be made. Now, one last thing I will say there is not simply about intelligence, is the automation of controls that you need to have for security, which includes all kinds of identity. Yeah. You have to fuse identity with the data and the access and dynamic controls that have to be there. It has all the automations that are needed for privacy ops. So you have responsible use of data that has to happen. And then mapping to all kinds of compliances that have to be more automated. And if you look around, it hasn't been done. People are just focused on either S3 or focused on some, you know, different silos. I think really is an opportunity to do it more holistically.
Got it. I do want to talk about the privacy part of it, but let's just focus on security. What would you say to somebody who'd say like, well, I'm the CDO, chief data officer. I've got a data DLP tool. And if I'm a fintech or, you know, somebody in a highly regulated industry vertical, I'm doing a DRM IAM type solution. Why do I need yet another tool in my tool bag? What would you tell them?
And so I think if you're saying about encryption, DRM or encryption, first of all, the encryption implies that it's gibberish, right?
Yep.
And gibberish implies it has no intelligence, and which implies it's useless. Which implies that, frankly, what's the use of the data? Which really means is that if you really want to make use of data, you're going to be opening it up. You're going to be sharing with some machine. You're going to be sharing with some user. You're going to be sharing with some software to process it. You're going to be sharing with AI algorithm to go look at it. That's where the problem starts. Because it's all jumbled up.
Got it.
You don't know which is sensitive, which is not. You don't know who's touching it, which machine is touching it. And I think that's where, and that's the reality. Till some magic homomorphic encryption pops up and we can say, look, I can figure out within the gibberish, I can figure this thing out. And that's why I think that's the reality, that we need the intelligence at scale and we need controls at the granular level. And privacy, what it brings is actually very unique. DLP has never dealt with it. And what is that uniqueness? Privacy requires that individual's data and individual right is about an individual's data. You need to figure out whose data it is, which DLP has never dealt with before, right? So I think there is clearly disruptions which are happening in the market, and I think new innovation will define new categories.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. And one more thing on data security is, are the solution to solving structured and unstructured data, which is, again, for everybody's databases versus like documents, do you think the problems and the solutions are same, similar, or they're vastly different problem domains as it pertains to security?
Certainly commonalities, because the definition of data has to be common. You really can't actually have multiple different grammars to define that data. And there is an opportunity here, Ankur, to actually learn the data from the structured systems and take it to unstructured and vice versa, especially when it comes to privacy, because it's the same human's data sitting both sides of the equation. Now, in terms of the controls, unquestionably, it's not just structured, unstructured, but it's actually system by system. Even within unstructured, you may have different kinds of controls that need to be applied. And as you know, with all the machine learning and Everfiles and all that, they could be clobs, they could be unstructured data sitting in structured systems, right? Audio files sitting in structured systems. So which means that boundary is going away. Or in Amazon S3, there could be a lot of structured data sitting because you're taking snapshots of your databases and so forth, right? So I think you have to look at more holistically and solve it in a way that you can apply common grammar, common detection, common policies, and disparate controls, whatever is suitable for that system. And that has not been done today. And I think that's really is the opportunity here.
Pretty vast opportunity, a complex problem, right? I mean, average application and the ones that I've built historically in SaaS, just this teeny tiny application relative to the big ones, dealt with like 10 different data stores, just within a single application, within a business unit, within a big company. Mm-hmm. You multiply that across all organizations right now, pick your favorite data store. I mean, you've got a data store sprawl. So I think on one spectrum, we need to solve the problem of like, how do we rein all the data stores in through a single pane of glass, like you said, but then second, solve it holistically, like not structured and unstructured data. It's gotta be all, but it's a complex problem. And I'm glad at least you are starting to think about it and are building a solution in that area.
And the things that you layer on top of it, you have to look through the lens of security, privacy, compliance. It cannot be either one of them because the obligations are all three.
Yeah.
It's not just one.
Yeah. 100%. So that definitely adds another dimension to it, which was kind of the segue I wanted to get into, which is beyond security. Let's talk about privacy. So obviously, you know, over the last 2-3 years, no thanks to all these breaches. I mean, average consumer has a lot of awareness about privacy. Enterprises certainly do. Zuck, in his prediction for the next decade, talked about privacy being the top 10 trends that he wants to focus on. Fred Wilson talked about privacy being the top 10 technology trends in the coming decade. So this is becoming a big thing. Yet, Rehan, the problem is that the average privacy persons that I have had to interact with, or when I look around, we're still filling up forms and paperwork. So my question to you is, like, what does the nirvana look like, right? Like, is it sort of like we're just going to pay lip service to GDPR and CCPA and say, yeah, like we have filled out these forms and can tell you we've got a separate stack? Or is there a bigger change that needs to happen? And what does a solution even look like, right? Like what do we need to prove, or enterprises need to prove, that they can tell confidently, not to just check a compliance box, but to really meet the local regulation requirement that they have the privacy down? Because the reality, today's reality, is pretty sobering. Like, we're making this prediction, but not a lot of tech innovation has happened in that area.
Yeah, I think this is actually exactly described the problem statement. And I think it is a symptom of a few things. The first is, when the regulation came in, the state of the technology that existed, and because people still need to get a check mark, and whatever was offered in the market at that time that got adopted, which was like a quicker way to get check mark. That's all. And I've seen that. I mean, part of the reason we kind of picked this problem, because we saw it with the firsthand, that it just took 2 weeks of surveys and maybe, you know, a couple of weeks of surveys to declare that you're GDPR compliant, which means almost nothing got done. And I think the reality is that privacy is actually about data privacy, right? And, you know, this is exactly what the laws are about. which means you have to understand an individual's data, tie it to the rights of their consent, revocation of consent, awareness, transparency, which means the stack has to literally be built and tied to the data of a single individual inside an organization. It's not that organizations would not do it. It's a matter of what technology they can be given to them. If it's given to them, it's just a matter of time that this is going to be adopted, because this is not going away. If you really look at the trajectory of this, this is not going away, which means more and more awareness is going to be there. And if the awareness is created that, guys, this is the right way to do it, don't do it in a way where you have a checkmark, but actually has no compliance. You know, my checkmark is there, but you actually have actually no compliance, and you're disrespecting in some ways the individuals whose data you're holding. And many companies who are actually building up, like Microsoft, Google, I would say you have to still commend them. You can go and exercise your rights, and they will give you the data. They've tied it back to the data. And they have these, some of the leading companies, like in particular, I would say Microsoft, Satya, they vocally kind of talked about it. Apple, Tim has talked about it. And they're tying it back to data. I think more and more companies, we clearly see, and we have customers at this point who take this as brand building exercise. They think it's privacy is good for business, good for trust. And I think that's what we are actually, frankly, trying to enable with the privacy ops. And privacy ops is all about tying it to data and automating the things so the headaches for the companies are less, and it's not about just getting paper check mark.
Yeah, well said. So now you've got the category or what you want to build down, which is in your case data. And the next phase of the journey is obviously, you know, getting the people to build the product you want, right? So in the last 2 years, you've managed to hire about 200 people, have 6 products with over 30 cloud connectors, which is kind of mind-boggling under the circumstances, under any circumstances, especially given what we have seen in the last year. How the hell did you hire so many people so fast in the middle of a pandemic?
A little update on that. We have 10 products and over 100 connectors.
Oh, holy cow. I may have written this question 2 weeks ago, Rehan.
I think it was probably part of a blog which was when we launched at RSA, we had 6 products about a year back. Since then, we have launched 4 more. Frankly, the answer really simply lies in people. It lies in the culture.
Yeah.
And it lies in the market opportunity. Right? And secondly, it lies in your approach on building products, right? The first thing I would say, the security team is really a special gang. We have worked on 4 different companies together. Many, many people. It's no magic, I would say. If the team has so much learnings from all the previous scars that we have from 3 previous companies, and there's a 4th one, it would not have been possible without this special team, frankly, that has come together. And frankly, they see the just like you asked the right questions, like the things that are not even getting done the right way. You clearly see the problem exists. It's a matter of building it and creating the awareness and creating another category, essentially, out of it, right? If we were trying to ramp one at a time, and it would not certainly have been certainly possible. Now, where we stand right now, if we wanted to grow even faster, we certainly can. And you'll probably see that in coming days. Another approach which we took was only possible because our investors gave us a bit credit for our previous projects. We literally, in the very first slide, put a platform picture. We literally put that picture and say, you know, this is a platform we're building. I think we have 3 use cases here. Well, I don't know which one is the first one, but most likely it is this one. But that's what we're going for. And I think many investors would have walked us out the door. But these guys, Mayfield and later John Katlis, they didn't. They gave the credit to the team and they said, okay, go ahead, do it. And it's like, here's $30 million. And because of the platform we invested, which we took about a year to actually invest, we are rapidly writing apps on top of it. Because if you really think to the core of a cybersecurity on a platform, 80% of things are common. And that's the reality. And somehow people keep rebuilding the same thing over and over again. I mean, if you look at how do you build connectors and how do you build data analysis, how do you build reporting, how do you build controls, how do you build policies, it's the same thing or very similar thing, I should be saying. And if you can take the commonality kind of out of the way and then keep expanding on the platform, you can write products. I mean, I can tell you many other companies have reached here over 3x more time and perhaps buying 5-6 companies. But I think it's a lot of hard work that that team has. Right, goes to the entirely goes to the team.
Yeah, for sure. You know, you mentioned that the investors obviously made a big bet on you, especially because you have a phenomenal track record. But one of the interesting things about this one relative to the other ones is that you raised like $81 million. And, you know, in startup land, like at least a couple of years ago, they used to say, you know, scarcity breeds innovation. But you've raised a lot of money. Why is that?
Yeah. I think firstly, the platform vision that we had to raise larger Series A. And we thought $31 million that we kind of got to was actually quite a big round. Frankly, in hindsight right now, at least not because of the situation that you're seeing right now, it looks like a tiny seed. I mean, right now people are using hundreds of millions of dollars as a Series A. And Series B, I did take no credit of raising that money. It frankly, it came in. Just after announcing Series A, we had inbound interest. It came in and we took it. In hindsight, it was the right thing to do because COVID hit. And the early days of COVID, you know, frankly, there was a lot of uncertainty, regardless of who you are. You know, first couple of months, and we were like, okay, thank God we took this money 2 months back, right? Now, the story is very different. Now, people are raising triple digit hundreds of millions of dollars, and unicorns are not a rarity. We get approached almost every week to take more money. Frankly, the money, the Series B kind of happened that way. And I think it was the right thing to do for the kind of the mission and the kind of platform that we're building.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think the landscape is very different right now. I think raising more to build out that once in a decade type company, I think the liquidity is there in the market and the investors are willing to bet on you, which is pretty incredible, right? Like, I think security needs one holistic solution, not yet another point solution. So kudos to the investors and yourself, obviously, to have that bigger vision. So now, you know, let's say you've got the category down, you got the people, you got the product down. The next series of questions I have is related sort of going to the market, right? And kind of scaling it, right? Like, and people kind of break it down into initial traction and product market fit and scaling and then exit, et cetera, et cetera. The question I have for you is obviously break down different stages of the journey, like acquisition of first 20 customers, then 100, then 500, and then 1,000. But more importantly, are you seeing any fundamental tectonic shift in the market in terms of the go-to-market, right? Like, is it still tops down, you know, sellers selling into CISOs? You're seeing a lot of bottoms-up go-to-market motion. Take us through the different phases of the product market fit or market traction, if you will, security or otherwise, right? Based on your experience and based on what you're seeing nowadays.
Yeah. I think if you're starting from scratch, the very first thing is, what are you doing? What are you building and why are you doing it? And why you? And these have to be answered more honestly. Otherwise, frankly, you may start a company, you may do a company, but may not be, you know, worthwhile. So, and there's a lot of uncertainty that comes along with that phase of starting, because there is no Google Maps that you put in some, you know, address and it'll tell you where to go. You're almost clueless, almost. You're literally looking at the stars and you're trying to figure out a way, a thing that, you know, how these things will line up, right? So I would say that is the hardest part. And that part actually doesn't go away for quite some time, because you're constantly trying to collect the data points and making sure that your conviction is not just your emotion. So I think that's really the first phase of it. And many customers, if you're basically doing a slightly better thing, and that, you know, some people are passionate about it, that's okay. Then maybe customers may be able to tell you, you can go talk to customer, read down his reports, and you can, you know, try to figure out a slightly better thing. But if you're trying to do something different and taking a bet, then that's the hardest part of the journey. And after that, of course, you want to make sure why you really means that, do you actually even have your team, yourself, have the ability to not only build something, but build something that is category defining. And that's where I think team really is the king. Your team, who's basically equally empowered and is able to execute, and enabling basically them to actually execute on it, especially on the product side. And then when you take to customers, early days, at least my learnings at, frankly, Elastic and other places, was there's not always you're going to get 100%, because it's not that you have universally acceptance. You don't need to have universal acceptance. But your diehard fans should be really your, you know, biggest advocates. Like, you can clearly see these are looking forward kind of customers. and they have the same conviction. They may be yep. small in number, but you basically work along with them along the journey. And if he's taking a bet on it, I think execution becomes a lot easier after that. A lot easier. Because if you have defined your path, you cannot, you know, frankly, just like when you don't know the path in a highway, then you're actually always looking and more anxious. But when you're on a highway and you're going straight, and then it's about like, okay, now you're executing. And there, because of lack of uncertainty, there is well-established principles and well-established mechanisms to, you know, to make the execution and the scale happen. That's at least the way I have experienced. That's the way I've looked at it. Now, of course, no question along the journey, there are transition points in which you have to scale. And we can talk more about that, but in those, you have to recognize those and shift gears in those points in the journey.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. I guess find the first 20, 30 passionate customers and then sort of make them super happy and then find a cohort of customers that looks very similar to the first 30 and then so on and so forth. Are you seeing any big go-to-market paradigm mm-hmm. shift? Like, you know, people are nowadays getting too enamored by sort of this bottoms-up go-to-market motion, self-service trials and trial to conversion. Do you think mm-hmm. security and SaaS security kind of is ready for this, or is it still going to be, by and large, sales-led, top-down motion, and then sort of augment that with bottoms-up? What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I think, first of all, bottoms-up is awesome. If there's a match.
Yeah.
Not every product actually is a match with bottoms-up, right? And you can give a free trial, yeah. and frankly, who cares? Because there's so many free trials out there,
yeah.
right? So now, if your audience is a practitioner, who has the ability, any practitioner, could be software developer, could be DevOps, could be any practitioner who has the ability, or could be, you know, literally a Slack user who has the ability to take your product and make use of it in a very short time and derive value out of it, right? If that your persona that you're targeting, if they do not have the ability to get there by themselves, the bottom up doesn't work at all, right? I mean, it doesn't mean the business doesn't exist. Business can still be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But you have to make that recognition and call right up front because not all products can be bottoms up. And frankly, the things that can be bottoms up, if you don't do it, you're actually doing a big disservice to your business, right? Because somebody else will do it and they will actually go and beat the crap out of you in the market, right? So I think that's really is a upfront assessment. And then, of course, while you're designing, that's where the design and user experience can actually play a huge role. That if you do think that this is bottoms up and self-serve and adoption can happen, then you really have to make sure that there is a mindless, and I really mean the mindless way to actually enable it and get some outcomes
yeah.
That can show you value. And from there, you can see, okay, at least now I can, you know, go from there. I think that's really the answer. So there's no one answer. You actually have to do thorough introspection and then pick the right path.
Yeah, no question about it. So let's say, you know, you found the market fit and initial traction and off to the races. And now sort of is the hard question, right? Which is when to exit, which is obviously coincidentally the theme of the podcast. And one of the hardest questions, you know, you've had two successful exits. I don't know if, you know, Elastic Exit is a public knowledge, but let's just say hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. We had Stu McClure just a few weeks ago, Cylance CEO, and he sold his company very successfully over $1 billion. Endpoint mm-hmm. security. But then obviously, you know, George Kurtz is running CrowdStrike and is now over, I don't know, $50-60 billion, depending on the week. So it's a hard question, right? Like, I mean, obviously when the startup and the company is struggling, it's easier. But, you know, when you're doing well, how do you know when to exit?
In fact, I would say instead of, let's say, whichever way you define exit, if somebody's, and yeah. there are two ways to look at it, if somebody's trying to sell their company, I think they're already in trouble. It means they're not aligned with the mission. And maybe something has gone, kind of either aspiration has gone away or, you know, whatever, right? In both cases, I can openly share with you, in case of Elastica and Vicorus and places, we never actually had hired a banker. We never actually went out to actually try to sell the company. In fact, in case of Elastica, there were two offers which came in earlier and we didn't think that aligned very well. And we passed on it, right? And passed in a way that we knew is great, great brands, but it's something that we're not going to be aligned or it's not going to take the mission forward. So I think The key thing, if you really want to, at the end, what you're trying to create is a value. Value for, first of all, for the market, yeah. For the customers. And by that, if that you can do that, and then of course to the, your shareholders, your employees, your team members, and all that yourself. But the key thing, if I would say, is to first focus on, heads down, focus on building category-defining products, building an iconic brand. Along the journey, if somebody knocks on your door, you can evaluate it at that time, and you can say, you know, maybe it will accelerate our mission in a dramatic way, or if that's the path you want to take, you can actually take it. Or you can say, look, on our own path, we can actually be really accelerated, and the market time is going to be right. I think that's really is the goal, the way to actually kind of look at it. In case of, I'll say, in security team's case, we, even when the Elastica was merged with Bluecode, the entire team pulled together to actually help Bluecode be positioned as a cloud company. And the outcome for Bluecode was amazing. And even at Symantec, the entire security team, you know, made StartSock be the fastest growing business there, which aligned with the mission. And you know, integrated seven or eight different Symantec products, and kind of a journey goes on. I think that what I would say was a good outcome itself, that today CloudSock itself is a cloud platform for Broadcom. I think that decision is there, be there. If you think somebody's going to take a product and is going to dig into a hole, I think that is the one big variable that you really have to account for. Unless you're at your end of your road. Sometimes, of course, that happens too.
Yeah, of course. Of course it does. Good stuff. So that brings me to, I think I'd say my last question, maybe second last, we'll see, which is, you know, you've had multiple successful exits. You're on your, obviously, most recent sojourn at security.ai. Basically, you can retire now, but somehow you like the pain more. You like to take more risks. Why is that?
I think maybe you want to be useful. Maybe it's the desire to be more useful. seriously. Yeah.
That's what my wife tells me. Can you be more useful in the household somehow?
My wife tells me exactly. Useful for others, what about me? I think it's maybe it's a bit of a calling in some ways. And I think you still feel like at the core, it is what energizes you. If what energizes you every day is to do something more that you call, in your view, call it useful, I think you're going to do that. And in my case, I think, frankly, it is creating some more value till I can. Just like the way I would say when I go hiking perhaps several times a week, I like the incline much, 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 much better than the decline. Maybe there's some metaphor relevance here.
Of course there is, yeah. I guess speaking of energizing, I mean, this can be all too draining day in and day out. Like there is never a dull moment in a CEO, GM's life. How do you recharge and re-energize yourself?
I think one thing is if you're really fired up to do something, perhaps, you know, you have a reason to wake up. But having said that, because there is still a lot of work, literally recording this over a weekend, right? And three areas, I think it needs to be recharged. One is, of course, physical recharging. It's just straightforward. You know, you just have to stay active. You have to eat wisely. But second thing is your emotional recharging. And whatever gives you that, for me, you know, you derive it from your relationships, your kids, your wife, your parents, your siblings, your friends. And frankly, the physical recharging probably gives you a bit more emotional recharging also. But the third thing, which is also important, is your third dimension is more spiritual recharging, right? You really need to have a sense of purpose. Yeah. And sense of being. So maybe getting yourself involved with other things which gives you more satisfaction, which is may not be material, but connecting to maybe higher powers, whichever higher powers you believe in, whichever way you when you practice that, I think sometimes can give you kind of a more grounding. And frankly, also can keep you very humble because you realize you're not even a dot on a planet, which is not even a dot itself in the entire universe. You don't take yourself too seriously.
Yeah, very well put. We can obviously do this all day long. I mean, there's so much to learn myself and for our listeners, but I want to be mindful of your time. So that brings us to the kind of the final segment of our show, Rapid Fire, Rehan. So I'll just ask you some simple question and answer, yes or no answers, short answers. All right, you ready to go?
Let's give it a try.
All right, let's do it. So I'm going to start with a googly, or in baseball, as they call the curveball, right? So, you know, there's a India-Pakistan cricket World Cup match, and it's a finals. And our listeners, I mean, you know, obviously I'm from India, Rehan is from Pakistan, you know, diehard cricket fans. You got to put half of your wealth on one team. Which team are you picking, Rehan?
I think I'll be rooting for Pakistan team. I'll put money on whichever is a favorite.
Okay, all right. Your wealth, half the wealth is gone, Rehan. You know that based on the recent games. Okay, got it. Good one. I mean, obviously, I didn't expect anything less from you. So, second one, you're a venture investor and you got to invest in one of these three founders in their early 20s. Okay, Bill Gates, Zuck, Elon, and Jeff, rather, four founders. Who are you putting your money on?
Bill Gates, because not only returns are great, the impact he's creating, in hindsight, I would say Bill Gates.
Yeah, he's love it. Totally. Which technology or technology trend will have the biggest impact over the next decade in how we work and play?
Unquestionably, I think it's deep learning. And of course, it's sitting on top of amazing infrastructure that has been built together. It is sitting on the shoulders of that, no question about it, but it's deep learning.
Look, we're in the 20th episode right now, 21st. I'd say 80% of our guests, when I ask that, it's consistently the same answer. AI, ML, deep learning. Yeah, love it. If you weren't building a company in security, what would you be doing?
I still find silicon and processors and GPUs very fascinating. old love. That dies hard.
Love it. Oh, yeah. What people, person, or thing has had the biggest influence on you?
I think my father and my maternal grandmother. She lost, as a villager, she lost her entire, almost entire family. And while she was, you know, she was expecting. And then she took care single-handedly, my mother, wow, and stood for her principles throughout her life and have big influence in our upbringings, my upbringing. So I'm really thankful to her. I miss her every day.
Yeah, inspiring stuff. And the last question, how can people learn more about your recent work? Is security.ai, is there a Twitter handle, anything else you want to share with the listeners?
I think, of course, security.ai webpage. And it's not just my work. I definitely do not take credit for it. It is entire team's work. And in fact, more their work than mine. I'm actually at their service and publicly so. So if you learn more about security team's work, that's actually that security.ai.
Awesome, Rehan. Well, that wraps up the episode of Zero to Exit. It's been a pleasure to have you on the pod. We appreciate you taking the time. Good luck rest of the way with your latest venture at Security AI as you go from zero to whatever the journey takes you to. Thank you, Rehan.
Ankur, thank you so very much for giving the opportunity. Great discussions. You had really great questions. Thanks so much.
Love it.